joined Republicans in passing a $4.6 billion bill for emergency aid at the southern border. The vote came after House Speaker Nancy Pelosi reversed her earlier pledge to push for more protections for migrant children to be included in the bill. 95 Democrats opposed the bill, including Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez of New York, who spoke out on CNN.
The problem right now and the question at hand right now is that Mitch McConnell sent us a bill and we're just putting a big check mark on it instead of even trying to negotiate.
The Congressional Hispanic Caucus issued a statement saying, quote, when the Congressional Hispanic Caucus members see suffering at the border, we see our children and our grandchildren. What happened today is unacceptable and we will not forget this betrayal, they said. Environmental groups are accusing the United States, Saudi Arabia, and Iran of blocking progress at a key international climate summit to discuss how to implement the landmark 2015 Paris Climate Accord. The summit was held in Bonn, Germany, in the midst of record heat waves being recorded across Europe. France has issued its first ever red weather alert, as temperatures are predicted to reach as high as 113 degrees Fahrenheit today. In parts of Spain, the temperature is expected to top 109 degrees Fahrenheit as Catalonia is battling its largest wildfire in decades. Authorities believe the fire began when a heap of manure self-ignited in the high heat. World leaders gathered in Japan today for the opening of the two-day G20 summit, which is expected to focus on Iran and the U.S.-China trade war. Earlier today, President Trump met with Russian President Vladimir Putin. When a reporter asked if Trump would raise Russia's meddling in U.S. elections, Trump smirked and then pointed his finger at Putin in a lighthearted way, telling him, don't meddle in the election. Meddle in the election, he said twice, pointing his finger at Putin. Meanwhile, there was a shakeup on President Trump's team heading to the G20. Trump's chief of diplomatic protocol, Sean Lawler, has resigned after he was accused of carrying a whip around his office and intimidating staff. Brazilian President Jair Bolsonaro is facing a new crisis after a Brazilian Air Force officer was arrested for attempting to smuggle 86 pounds of cocaine into Spain. The officer had flown into the country on a presidential plane that was headed to the G20. Bolsonaro, who was not on board the flight, had campaigned on vowing to crack down on drug traffickers. A pregnant woman in Alabama who was shot in the stomach has been charged with manslaughter herself, because the shooting caused her pregnancy to end. Marche Jones, a 28-year-old African-American woman, was charged on Wednesday and released Thursday after posting a $50,000 bond. Local police accused Jones of starting the fight that led to the shooting in the parking lot of a Dollar General store outside of Birmingham. The case's alarm reproductive rights activists, the National Abortion Federation, said, quote, this is how people, especially women of color, are already being punished and having their pregnancies criminalized, unquote. Alabama is one of 38 states to have a fetal homicide law. In news from Women's World Cup, the co-captain of the U.S. women's soccer team, Megan Rapinoe, is standing by her remarks that she would refuse to go to the White House if invited. Rapinoe first told 8x8 magazine, quote, I am not going to the effing White House.
White House. No, I'm not going to the White House. That's, okay. We're not going to be invited.
You're not going to be invited?
I doubt it.
On Thursday, Megan Rapinoe stood by her comments ahead of today's World Cup quarterfinal match against France.
I don't think that I would want to go, and I would encourage my teammates to think hard about lending that platform or having that co-opted by an administration that doesn't feel the same way and doesn't fight for the same things that we fight for. So.
Megan Rapinoe has also made headlines during the World Cup for refusing to sing the national anthem and put her hand on her heart ahead of games. In Kansas City, Missouri, the body of a 32-year-old trans woman of color was found Tuesday morning. Brooklyn Lindsay is believed to be at least the 11th trans woman of color to be murdered this year. The Kansas City Anti-Violence Project's holding a vigil for her this weekend. And today marks the 50th anniversary of the Stonewall Uprising. On this day in 1969, the New York Police Police Department raided the Stonewall Inn, a gay and trans-friendly bar in Manhattan's Greenwich Village. It triggered an uprising and helped launch the modern-day LGBTQ rights movement. In New York, two major marches are planned for Sunday, the New York City Heritage of Pride Parade and the alternative non-corporate Queer Liberation March. We'll look back at the Stonewall uprising later in the broadcast. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In a devastating blow to voting rights, the Supreme Court ruled Thursday federal courts cannot strike down extreme gerrymandered congressional maps. In a narrow 5-4 opinion by the court's conservative majority, Chief Justice John Roberts wrote that gerrymandering is irreconcilable with democratic principles, but that this does not mean the solutions are within the federal judiciary. The decision leaves in place gerrymandered districts in North Carolina and Maryland, where the party in power drew districts to weaken the opposing party. The ruling now leaves confronting gerrymandering to the states. In a powerful dissent, Justice Elena Kagan wrote, quote, "In giving such gerrymanders a pass from judicial review, the majority goes tragically wrong. Is that how American democracy is supposed to work? I have yet to meet the person who thinks so." She continued, "Partisan gerrymandering can make elections meaningless. At its most extreme, as in North Carolina and Maryland, the practice amounts to rigging elections," she said. This comes as the Supreme Court temporarily blocked the Trump administration from adding a citizenship status question on the 2020 census, arguing the government had lied when it said the question was added to enforce the Voting Rights Act. But the court did not strike the question down either. On Thursday, President Trump threatened to delay next year's census. Well, for more, we're joined by Ari Berman, senior writer at Mother Jones, reporting fellow at The Nation, author of Give Us the Ballot, The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America. His new piece, Why It's Almost Impossible for the Citizenship Question to Make It Onto the Census. Let's start there, Ari. Let's start with the High Court saying they would not, at this moment, allow the citizenship question because the Trump administration did not explain why it wanted it.
It was actually a surprising opinion, Amy, because a lot of people expected the conservative majority in the court to uphold the citizenship question, despite all the evidence showing that this was discriminatory and unnecessary and would suppress immigrant communities. But basically what John Roberts said, writing for the majority, was that the Trump administration could add a question about citizenship to the census, but they had to have a good reason to do so. And their reason that this was needed to enforce the Voting Rights Act, in Roberts' words, quote, seems to be contrived. Now, this was obvious from the very beginning. The Trump administration hasn't filed a single lawsuit to enforce the Voting Rights Act. So, of course, they have no interest in enforcing the Voting Rights Act. But it was still bracing to hear John Roberts say this. And so now what happens is the administration has to come back with a better rationale. Even if they do, which I'm skeptical they'll be able to do, time is running out. The Census Bureau said they need to finalize the forms by the end of this month because the census is a $10 to $15 billion operation that needs to be planned well in advance. Meanwhile, lower courts in both New York and Maryland are looking at smoking gun evidence that a GOP redistricting strategist push this question to help GOP and whites. So if the courts look at more evidence, that's not going to reflect well on the Trump administration either.
So the Trump administration is asking for a delay. What does this mean? I mean, as you said, it's constitutionally mandated. Every 10 years, the census takes place.
Well, the Justice Department's going to try to ask for more time to defend its position and come up with a new rationale. And Trump is saying that he wants to actually delay the census, which is unprecedented and also unconstitutional. The census is constitutionally mandated to begin in April of 2020. It can't be delayed because Donald Trump doesn't get the question that he wants on the form.
Now let's turn to the other decision. Writing for the majority, Chief Justice John Roberts said the drafters of the Constitution realized that politics would influence how election districts are drawn when they gave that job to state legislatures. He said judges are not in the position to question lawmakers' decision. Roberts wrote, quote, "We conclude that partisan gerrymandering claims present political questions beyond the reach of the federal courts." What does this mean, Ari?
This decision by John Roberts in the gerrymandering case is almost guaranteed to facilitate massive election rigging in the future. Because what John Roberts is saying is that no matter how extreme the maps, courts not only can't strike them down, they can't even review them, Amy. That is such a radical position. And we've seen such extreme gerrymandering passed in 2010 in places like Wisconsin, where Republicans have gotten 46% of the votes, but 64% of seats. That's so deeply undemocratic. And now we're entering a new redistricting cycle in 2021. And when the Supreme Court basically says, you guys can do whatever you want, that means the maps passed in 2021 and the next redistricting cycle could be even more extreme than the rigged maps we saw after 2010.
So what about North Carolina and Maryland exactly?
What it means is that basically the court said you need to vacate the lower court decisions, striking down these gerrymanders. And courts overwhelmingly throughout the country have struck down gerrymandered maps in the lower courts, in Wisconsin, in North Carolina, in Maryland, in Pennsylvania. And those decisions, if they happened in federal court, are now vacant. What the Supreme Court says is this can only be dealt with at the state issue. It can either be dealt with in state courts, or states can pass things like independent redistricting commissions. Some states will do that, but some states won't. And for decades, people that have been disenfranchised have looked to the federal courts, and the Supreme Court in particular, for protection. Now they can't do that any longer.
So we've had two nights of presidential debate. We're going to go to excerpts soon, but we won't be playing any excerpts of questions around voting rights.
We won't. And this is really distressing, Amy. We've had 25 debates in 2016, two debates so far in 2020, not a single question about the gutting of the Voting Rights Act or the attack on voting rights. We had huge Supreme Court decisions on gerrymandering and the census yesterday that's going to shape democracy for a decade. Not one question in the debate last night about it. The media keeps treating the right to vote as a fringe issue, as opposed to the right that makes all other rights possible. If we continue to ignore this, make it seem like it doesn't matter, we're going to see the effects of our democracy. We're going to see the voter suppression, the gerrymandering, the rigging of the census that has occurred in the past. That's going to get even worse now going forward if we don't deal with this issue. So the debates are a huge platform that many, many people who don't follow politics in and out are paying attention to. If they don't hear about what's happening with gerrymandering, what's happening with voter suppression, they might not even know what's going on. So I really hope in the future at all of these Democratic forums this comes up, because the Democrats have actually started addressing these issues. They're talking about voter suppression. They're talking about gerrymandering. They're talking about the census. But it needs to come up in the debates when the most people are paying attention.
Well, Ari Berman, I want to thank you for being with us. Senior writer at Mother Jones, reporting fellow at Tite Media Center, author of Give Us the Ballot, The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America. We'll link to your piece, Why It's Almost Impossible for the Citizenship Question to Make It Onto the Census. When we come back, Senator Kamala Harris takes on former Vice President Joe Biden in the second night of the first Democratic primary debate. We'll play highlights and speak with President of Color of Change, Rashad Robinson, and Andrea McCallu in Miami, Executive Director of the New Florida Majority. Stay with us. You Goodbye by Bleach. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman as we turn to the second night of the first Democratic presidential primary debate, which was billed as a face-off between the frontrunners, former Vice President Joe Biden and Senator Bernie Sanders. But that's not quite how it turned out. It was California Senator Kamala Harris who took command of the stage as she sparred Thursday night over Biden's recent comments about working with segregationists in the Senate and for his opposition to Delaware's attempts to bus students in an effort to integrate its schools in the 70s.
I'm going to now direct this at Vice President Biden. I do not believe you are a racist. And I agree with you when you commit yourself to the importance of finding common ground. But I also believe, and it's personal, and I was actually very, it was hurtful to hear you talk about the reputations of two United States senators who built their reputations and career on the segregation of race in this country. And it was not only that, but you also worked with them to oppose busing. And, you know, there was a little girl in California who was part of the second class to integrate her public schools. And she was bused to school every day. And that little girl was me.
It's a mischaracterization of my position across the board. I did not praise racists. That is not true, number one. Number two, if we want to have this campaign litigated on who supports civil rights and whether I did or not, I'm happy to do that. I was a public defender. I didn't become a prosecutor. I came out and I left a good law firm to become a public defender. In terms of busing, you would have been able to go to school the same exact way because it was a local decision made by your city council. That's fine. That's one of the things I argued for, that we should be breaking down these lines. But so the bottom line here is, look, everything I've done in my career, I ran because of civil rights. I continue to think we have to make fundamental changes in civil rights. And those civil rights, by the way, include not just only African Americans, but the LGBT community.
But Vice President Biden, do you agree today that you were wrong to oppose busing in America then?
No,
do you agree?
I did not oppose busing in America. What I opposed is busing ordered by the Department of Education. That's what I opposed.
Well,
I
there
did
was
not
a failure of states to integrate public schools in America. I was part of the second class to integrate Berkeley, California public schools almost two decades after Brown v. Board of Education.
Because your city council made that decision. It was a local decision.
So that's where the federal government must step in. That's why we have the Voting Rights Act and the Civil Rights Act. That's why we need to pass the Equality Act. That's why we need to pass the ERA, because there are moments in history where states fail to preserve the civil rights of all people.
I have supported the ERA from the very beginning when I ran.
Vice President Biden, 30 seconds, because I want to bring other people into this.
I supported the ERA from the very beginning. I'm the guy that extended the Voting Rights Act for 25 years. We got to the place where we got 98 out of 98 votes in the United States Senate doing it. I've also argued very strongly that we, in fact, deal with the notion of denying people access to the ballot box. I agree that everybody, once they, in fact, they should. Anyway, my time's up. I'm sorry.
But that's not what Biden said in 1975, telling a Delaware newspaper, "I oppose busing. It's an asinine concept, the utility of which has never been proven to me. I've gotten to the point where I think our only recourse to eliminate busing may be a constitutional amendment," he said. The attack from Harris came after Biden made headlines last week when he finally reminisced about his civil relationships in the 70s and 80s with segregationist Senators James Eastland of Mississippi and Herman Talmadge of Georgia. In the 70s, then-Senator Biden was also a fierce critic of Delaware's attempts to bus students in an effort to integrate its schools. Earlier this week, we spoke with National Book Award-winning author Jonathan Kozol about Biden's record. Kozol recently wrote a piece in The Nation when Joe Biden collaborated with segregationists.
Joe Biden didn't simply reach out in consensus, some kind of civility to these Southern racist senators. It wasn't hard for him to reach out because he shared their views in the first place. He didn't just support legislation introduced by James Eastland or Jesse Helms. He thanked them for supporting his legislation and his own anti-busing legislation. He called busing asinine. And, you know, and more than, and worse than that, at one point he even came to the point of saying, I want to get his words exact, of saying, I've gotten to the point where I think our only recourse to eliminate busing is a constitutional amendment. Just stunning words. Last week he said he has no apologies. The media, you know, has quoted him repeatedly saying, you know, I've been involved with civil rights my whole career. But this is simply I don't know how to word this politely, but this is simply not the truth. To the extent that he's been involved with civil rights, it hasn't been as an advocate. It's been as an opponent.
It hasn't been as an advocate. It's been as an opponent to busing. Those are the words of former teacher, education activist, award-winning author Jonathan Kozol. Well, for more, we're joined here in New York by Rashad Robinson, president of Color of Change. So this was billed really as the Biden-Bernie debate. That's not what happened. Talk about this challenge that Senator Harris uses to take down Joe Biden.
Yeah, I mean, I think Biden once again is trying to run a modern campaign with an old set of tactics. It's like putting new music on an 8-track, and it just simply doesn't work because we have no way to sort of fully operationalize it. The fact of the matter is that the vice president went on the stage last night and argued for states' rights. He argued for local control. Any of us who see any images, whether just in the month of February, Black History Month, of the history of black children being walked into schools with crowded, you know, white people chanting at them, is about the federal government having to step in to do things when the local governments wouldn't do it. And someone running for president that is basically arguing that that is not a role for the federal government should scare all of us. Now, I do think that Biden needs to explain what he actually meant, then and what he actually believes now. But the big challenge that we continue to have here is the inability to apologize, whether it was Anita Hill, whether it was for sort of the remarks with segregationists, this inability to say, I was wrong then. You know, Bill Clinton gave him a lifeline when it comes to the crime bill. And Hillary Clinton, you know, apologized multiple times for her engagement in the crime bill back in 2016.
Maybe he sees that as an example of, well, she lost.
Well, she lost, exactly. But she also lost as someone who leaned on experience as her chief sort of claim to fame. And so Biden talking about his experience since the 70s, I just think sort of, defeating a guy in the White House, a 70-year-old man who's deeply out of touch with working class people, everyday people, and who refuses to apologize and acknowledge that he's wrong, is not going to be beaten by putting up the left version of that. And so I do think that, you know, there's a lot of opportunity for Biden. But as a civil rights leader and running a next generation civil rights organization that has 1.7 million members, we've reached out to meet with many of the campaigns, and we've met with most of the top tier campaigns. Biden's a campaign that we simply have not been able to hear back from.
Have you spoken to Kamala Harris?
Yes, we have multiple times. And multiple times, you know, one of the things that we've really talked to Kamala Harris about, which didn't come out last night because there were no questions about mass incarceration last night. One of the things we have talked about is that we do think that she has to get very clear about her role as a prosecutor. We do think that...
It's interesting. Biden slipped in a comment people might not have caught. Yeah. He said, I was a public defender, not a prosecutor.
And I think that it's really hard for him to go much further given his role in the crime bill. But I do think that sort of her closing statement around being a progressive prosecutor, I think she won last night, and I think she won it in a way that really sets her into a new tier of the candidates. But I do think that there's going to be a new look at her role as a prosecutor. And the question here is that the country has changed from when she was a prosecutor in San Francisco. We have just seen, you know, progressive prosecutors driven by a movement of everyday people pushing in Philadelphia, Chicago, right here in New York and Queens, all around the country, people standing up and trying to change the rules of prosecution in this country. The question is what has she learned? How has she changed? And as the President of the United States, what will she do to incentivize a new incentive structure for prosecutors who have so much vast power over the criminal justice system? They decide so much. They have singular power. And the fact of the matter is that, you know, unlike the president, which has to do all of these things to change things in the criminal justice, well over 80% of people in this country are incarcerated at the local level. DAs control it. Right now, nearly 80% of district attorneys run unopposed. 90% are white. There are 2,400 district attorneys in this country, but lots of federal funding goes into those communities. And we can incentivize or de-incentivize certain behaviors. And so I want to hear from her, as someone who was in that role, what type of things should be done to change the way that mass incarceration works in this country. And that's got to be something that we've got to hear more from her.
And of course, she was Attorney General of California. Well, I want to go back to the Democratic presidential primary debate Thursday night when NBC anchor Savannah Guthrie asked candidates if their government health care plan would provide coverage for undocumented immigrants. They all raised their hands.
Raise your hand if your government plan would provide coverage for undocumented immigrants. Okay. Let me start with you, Mayor Buttigieg. Why? Mayor Buttigieg, why?
Because our country is healthier when everybody is healthier. And remember, we're talking about something people are given a chance to buy into. In the same way that there are undocumented immigrants in my community who pay. They pay sales taxes. They pay property taxes directly or indirectly. This is not about a handout. This is an insurance program. And we do ourselves no favors by having 11 million undocumented people in our country be unable to access health care. But of course, the real problem is we shouldn't have 11 million undocumented people with no pathway to citizenship. It makes no sense. And the American people agree on what to do. This is a crazy thing. If leadership consists of forming a consensus around a divisive issue, this White House has divided us around a consensus issue. The American people want a pathway to citizenship. They want protections for dreamers. We need to clean up the lawful immigration system, like how my father immigrated to this country. And as part of a compromise, we can do whatever common sense measures are needed at the border. But Washington can't deliver on something the American people want. What does that tell you about the system we're living in? It tells you it needs profound structural reform.
Vice President Biden, I believe you said that your health care plan would not cover undocumented immigrants. Could you explain your position?
I'm sorry, I beg your pardon.
I believe at the show of hands, you did not raise your hand. Did you raise your hand?
No, I did. Sorry.
You said they would be covered under your plan, which is different than Obamacare.
Yes, but here's the thing.
Can you explain that change?
Yes. You cannot let, as the mayor said, you cannot let people who are sick, no matter where they come from, no matter what their status, go uncovered. You can't do that. It's just going to be taken care of, period. You have to. It's a humane thing to do. But here's the deal. The deal is that he's right about three things. Number one, they, in fact, contribute to the well-being of the country, but they also, for example, they've increased the lifespan of Social Security because they have a job, they're paying a Social Security tax. That's what they're doing. It's increased the lifespan. They would do the same thing in terms of reducing the overall cost of health care by them being able to be treated and not wait till they're an extremis. The other thing is, folks, look, we can deal with these insurance companies. We can deal with the insurance companies by, number one, putting insurance executives in jail for their misleading advertising, what they're doing on opioids, what they're doing paying doctors to prescribe. We could be doing this by making sure everyone who is on Medicare, that the government should be able to negotiate the price for whatever the drug costs are. We can do this by making sure that we're in a position that we, in fact, allow people.
That was Joe Biden. For more, we go to Miami, where we're joined by Andrew Mercado, executive director of the New Florida Majority. Her recent op-ed in the New York Times headlined, Democrats can win Florida in 2020. Talk about what was and was not raised in these two nights of debates, Andrea. You, whose organization is part of a number of organizations that were responsible, for example, for bringing a number of these candidates less than an hour away to Homestead, where the Caliburn detention facility is, where more than 2,000 children, migrant children, are incarcerated. Among those who went there was Bernie Sanders, was Kamala Harris, was Senator Warren, was Eric Swalwell. Not Kamala Harris, but Amy Klobuchar.
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's a lot of discourse on immigration the past two nights, and a real conversation around decriminalizing our immigration system. It's a conversation that many of us who have been in the immigrant rights movement couldn't have imagined presidential candidates really engaging in a few years ago. And so it's heartening to see that. And at the same time, we see this back and forth between Senator Harris and Biden, with Senator Harris pointing to secure communities and the need for victims of crime to be able to reach out to police when they need help and not to fear their deportation. And Senator Biden and really pushing the Senator Biden on the Obama administration's record of the deportations that we saw under that administration. And just like he needs to answer to the 94 crime bill, they also have to talk about the deportation of immigrants under that administration and how we're going to advance forward as a country at this moment where we're witnessing unspeakable horrors at the border with the incarceration of children in Homestead just a few miles away. But I would say two of the topics that really weren't discussed in the last two nights' debates, we did not see much attention to climate change. We didn't see a real robust conversation about what we need to do to protect this planet for future generations. Here in Florida, we're ground zero for some of the impacts of climate change in the United States. We have over 10,000 people in the panhandle that has been devastated by Hurricane Michael and 10,000 people who are homeless. Just like we have over 3,000 people in Puerto Rico who died because of the negligence of the Trump administration. So I think we need to see candidates having much more substantive conversation about climate change.
On the issue of immigration and providing health care to undocumented immigrants, President Trump has already tweeted, even though he's in Japan now, the G20, all Democrats just raise their hands for giving millions of illegal aliens unlimited health care. How about taking care of American citizens first? That's the end of that race! Exclamation point. Teresa, Andrea.
That is the Trump playbook. I mean, the Republican Party invests millions of dollars in deporting immigrants, in scapegoating immigrants for economic insecurity and the fact that, our families are struggling to make ends meet and survive in working class communities across this nation. They're trying to confuse us and distract us from the fact that all of the policies that this administration are promoting and that Republicans are passing are to benefit the richest Americans, the top 1%, the biggest corporations, and do irrevocable harm to our democracy and well-being.
The significance of Florida as a swing state.
I mean, it's clear that the path to the White House goes through Florida. No Republican has won the White House without winning Florida since, 1920s. The Republicans are really investing heavily here in building out their infrastructure. They've been winning elections in Florida by less than half a percent in a state with 22 million people. And, to win in Florida, we really need the Democratic Party to show up and to engage their base. The African Americans, their most loyal voters and the heart of the Democratic Party, as well as Latinos whose votes are critical in this state. And, we need to see that engagement early and often, and we need to be candidates not to be complacent, about just standing against Trump. I think that was a real misstep that Biden made last night. We need candidates that actually are going to speak to the issues that our families face.
I want to go back to Thursday night's Democratic debate, to the exchange between Vice President Biden and Senator Bernie Sanders on the issue of Iraq. It begins with moderator Rachel Maddow.
You have made your decades of experience in foreign policy a pillar of your campaign. But when the time came to say yes or no on one of the most consequential foreign policy decisions of the last century, you voted for the Iraq War. You have since said you regret that vote. But why should voters trust your judgment when it comes to making a decision about taking the country to war the next time?
Because once Bush abused that power, what happened was we got elected after that. I made sure the president turned to me and said, Joe, get our combat troops out of Iraq. I was responsible for getting 150,000 combat troops out of Iraq, and my son was one of them. I also think we should not have combat troops in Afghanistan. It's long overdue. It should end. And I thirdly, I believe that you're not going to find anybody who has pulled together more of alliances to deal with what is the real stateless threat out there. We cannot go it alone in terms of dealing with terrorism. So I'd eliminate the act that allowed us to go into war and not the AUMF, and make sure that it could only be used for what its intended was, what its intent was, and that is to go after terrorists, but never do it alone. That's why we have to repair our alliances. We put together 65 countries to make sure we dealt with ISIS in Iraq and other places. That's what I would do, that's what I have done, and I know how to do it.
Senator Sanders, 30 seconds.
One of the differences that Joe and I have in our record is Joe voted for that war. I helped lead the opposition to that war, which is a total disaster. Second of all, I helped lead the effort for the first time to utilize the War Powers Act to get the United States out of the Saudi-led intervention in Yemen, which is the most horrific humanitarian disaster on earth. And thirdly, let me be very clear, I will do everything I can to prevent a war with Iran, which would be far worse than disastrous war with
Iraq. Senator Sanders,
I mean, it's interesting that you have Bernie Sanders also not only raising the issue of Iraq, but of Yemen. And this debate was on NBC and MSNBC, because FAIR noted in 2018, they said in the year 2017, MSNBC ran only one segment that focused on the U.S.'s role in Yemen, zero in the second half of the year. In 2018, so far, they wrote, MSNBC hasn't run a single segment on Yemen, much less the U.S.'s role in it. But Rashad Robinson, the significance of the Biden-Bernie Sanders sparring around the issue of war.
I think it's really important. I think that this is why we have debates, that people need to get clear about sort of where folks stand. You know, back in 08, you know, Hillary Clinton's support of that war and inability to sort of talk about it was one of the things that really helped Obama catapult to top tier status, especially among progressive folks. This goes back to what I was saying earlier, is that we need to understand what Biden has learned during his decades of service, how he has changed, what made a politician someone that we might vote for in the 90s, what made a politician someone that a young black person might vote for in the early 2000s is very different than today. And he's going to have to walk us through sort of what he's learned while being in office and how he's changed. And unfortunately, he didn't really answer that question.
I want to go very quickly to South Bend, Indiana. This is Rachel Maddow questioning South Bend, Indiana Mayor Pete Buttigieg about the police shooting of Eric Logan, a black man, last month. Buttigieg is then interrupted. Here we go.
Mayor Buttigieg. In the last 5 years, civil rights activists in our country have led a national debate over race and the criminal justice system. Your community of South Bend, Indiana has recently been in uproar over an officer-involved shooting. The police force in South Bend is now 6% black in a city that is 26% black. Why has that not improved over your two terms as mayor?
Because I couldn't get it done. My community is in anguish right now because of an officer-involved shooting, a black man, Eric Logan, killed by a white officer. And I'm not allowed to take sides until the investigation comes back. The officer said he was attacked with a knife, but he didn't have his body camera on.
There is Pete Buttigieg, and he went on from there. Rashad Robinson.
You know, he said he couldn't get the job done. So the question is why are you running for president? I'm looking forward to sitting down and hearing that from him. But the question really is that in South Bend, Indiana right now, the black community is hurting. They want their mayor to stand up and figure out how he's going to make safety and justice a reality.
And I wanted to end with Pete Buttigieg's closing comment. This is Pete Buttigieg's closing comment last night. Well, I don't think we have it in SOP. Here we go.
The experience of writing a letter to my family, putting it in an envelope marked just in case, and leaving it where they would know where to find it in case I didn't come back from Afghanistan. I have the experience of being in a marriage that exists by the grace of a single vote on the U.S. Supreme Court.
A single vote on the U.S. Supreme Court. Yeah. Rashad, we're just about to go into the 50th anniversary of Stonewall documentary. This is the day, 1:30 after midnight tonight. You are a well-known LGBTQ activist. There will be millions of people in the streets in New York here.
Yeah, I think those were powerful words from Mayor Pete. I mean, him being on the stage is a representation of progress. As a leader of a national black civil rights organization, I know that I sit on the shoulders of folks like Marsha P. Johnson, who threw that first stone, folks like Bayard Rustin, folks like Audre Lorde, and so many other black gay people who were proud, unapologetic, and demanded that this country live up to everything that it could possibly be. I hope that we celebrate Stonewall, but I also hope we celebrate what's under it, and that's that every single day, in order to make our country whole, in order to make justice and democracy real, we have to translate the presence of these issues into the power to change the rules, to make everyday people heard, counted, and visible.
Rashad Robinson, I want to thank you for being with us, President of Color of Change, and Andrea Mercado from Miami, Executive Director of the New Florida Majority. We'll be back in 20 seconds.
Oh, man, sunshine, listen you. Never tell me dreams come true. Just try it, and I'll start a riot.
Beatrice but not for me, died. Sung by Judy Garland. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. 50 years ago today, it was just after midnight at 1:30 in the morning of June 28, 1969, New York City police officers raided a gay and trans-friendly bar called the Stonewall Inn on Christopher Street in Greenwich Village. As the police began dragging some of the patrons out, the community fought back, sparking 3 days of rioting. The historic resistance launched the modern-day LGBTQ movement that became known as the Stonewall Uprising. We turn today to some of the original voices of those people who led the uprising. This documentary produced by Dave Isay in 1989, Remembering Stonewall.
I am Gene Harwood, and my age is 80.
I'm Bruce Merrill.
I don't know if it's really true, but now people do refer to us as the two oldest gay men in America. We do, have maybe a record relationship of almost 60 years together. Being gay before Stonewall was a very difficult proposition because we felt that in order to survive, we had to try to look and act as rugged and manly as possible to get by in the society that was really very much against us.
My name is Randy Wicker. I was the first openly gay person to appear on radio in 1962 and on television in 1964 as a self-identified homosexual. In the year before Stonewall, people felt a need to hide because of the precarious legal position they were in. They would lose their jobs. There was a great hostility, socially speaking, in the sense of people found out you were gay. They assumed you were a communist or a child molester or any of another dozen stereotypes that were rampant in the public media at the time.
I'm Jerry Fair, and I'm 80 years old. I started a gay lifestyle in 1948 when I was around 39 or 40. At that time, if there was even a suspicion that you were a lesbian, you were fired from your job, and you were in such a position of disgrace that you slunk out without saying goodbye even to the people that liked you and you liked. Never even bothered to clean your desk. You just disappeared. You just disappeared. You went quietly because you were afraid that the recriminations that would come if you even stood there and protested would be worse than just leaving.
My name is Sylvia Rivera. My name before that was Ray Rivera until I started dressing in drag in 1961. The era before Stonewall was a hard era. There was always the gay bashings on the drag queens by heterosexual men, women, and the police. We learned to live with it. because it was part of the lifestyle at that time, I guess. But none of us were very happy about it.
My name is Seymour Pine. In 1968, I was assigned as deputy inspector in charge of public morals in the 1st Division in the police department, which covered the Greenwich Village area. It was the duty of public morals to enforce all laws concerning vice and gambling, including prostitution, narcotics, and laws and regulations concerning homosexuality. The part of the penal code which applied to drag queens was section 240.35, section 4. Being masked or in any manner disguised by unusual or unnatural attire or facial alteration, loiters, remains, or congregates in a public place with other
persons. At that time we lived at the Arista Hotel.
Except that such conduct.
We sit around. Just try to figure out when this harassment would come to an end. And we would always dream that one day it would come to an end. And we prayed and we looked for it. We wanted to be human beings.
On Friday evening, June 27, 1969, at about 11:45, 8 officers from New York City's Public Morals Squad loaded into 4 unmarked police cars and headed to the Stonewall Inn here at 7th Avenue and Christopher Street. The local precinct had just received a new commanding officer, who kicked off his tenure by initiating a series of raids on gay bars. The Stonewall was an inviting target, operated by the Gambino crime family without a liquor license. The dance bar drew a crowd of drag queens, hustlers, and minors. A number of the bar's patrons had spent the early part of the day outside the Frank Campbell funeral home, where Judy Garland's funeral was held. She had died the Sunday before. It was almost precisely at midnight that the Morals Squad pulled up to the Stonewall Inn, led by Deputy Inspector Seymour Pine.
There was never any reason to feel that anything of any unusual situation would occur that night.
You could actually feel it in the air. You really could. I guess Judy Garland's death just really helped us really hit the fan.
For some reason, things were different this night. As we were bringing the prisoners out, they were resisting.
People started gathering in front of the Sheridan Square Park right across the street from Stonewall. People were upset. No, we're not going to go. And people started screaming and hollering.
One drag queen, as we put her in the car, opened the door on the other side and jumped out, at which time we had to chase that person, and he was caught, put back into the car. He made another attempt to get out the same door, the other door, and at that point we had to handcuff the person. From this point on, things really began to get crazy.
My name is Robert Rivera, and my nickname is Birdie, and I've been cross-dressing all of my life. I remember the night of the riots. The police were escorting the queens out of the bar and into the paddy wagon, and there was this one particularly outrageously beautiful queen with stacks and stacks of Elizabeth Taylor-style hair, and she was asking them not to push her. And they continued to push her, and she turned around and she mashed the cop with her high heel. She knocked him down, and then she proceeded to frisk him for the keys to the handcuffs that were on her. She got them, and she undid herself and passed them to another queen that was behind her.
Well, that's when all hell broke loose at that point. And then we had to get back into the Stonewall.
My name is Martin Boyce, and in 1969, I was a drag queen known as Miss Martin. I remember on that night, when we saw the riot police, all of us drag queens, we linked arms like the Rockettes and sang the song we used to sing. We are the village girls. We wear our hair in curls. We wear our dungarees above our Nelly knees. And the police went crazy hearing that, and they just immediately rushed us. We gave one kick and fled.
My name is Rudy, and the night of the Stonewall, I was 18. And to tell you the truth, that night I was doing more running than fighting. I remember looking back from 10th Street. And there on Waverly Street, there was a police, I believe, on his cop, and is on his stomach in his tactical uniform and his helmet and everything else, with a drag queen straddling him. She was beating the hell out of him with her shoe. Whether it was a high heel or not, I don't know. But she was beating the hell out of him. It was hysterical.
Yeah. My name is Mama Jean. I'm a lesbian. I remember on that night, I was in a gay bar, a women's bar, called Cookies. We were coming out of the gay bar, going toward 8th Street. And that's when we saw everything happen, blasting away, people getting beat up, police coming from every direction, hitting women as well as men with their nightsticks, gay men running down the street with blood all over their face. We decided right then and there whether we were scared or not. We didn't think about it. We just jumped in.
Here, this queen is going completely bananas, you know, jumping and hitting the windshield. And next thing you know, the taxi cab was being turned over, or the cars were being turned over, things. Windows were shattering all over the place. Fires were burning around the place. It was beautiful. It really was. It was really beautiful.
I remember one cop coming at me, hitting me with the nightstick in the back of my legs. I broke loose and I went after him. I grabbed his nightstick. My girlfriend went behind him. She was a strong 7 again. I wanted him to feel the same pain I felt. And I kept on saying to him, how do you like the pain? Do you like it? Do you like it? And I kept on hitting him and hitting him. I was angry. I wanted to kill him. At that particular minute, I wanted to kill him.
I wanted to do every destructive thing that I could think of at that time to hurt anyone that had hurt us through the years.
It's like just when you see a man protecting his own life. They weren't the queens that people call them. They were men fighting for their lives. And I'd fight alongside them any day, no matter how old I was.
A lot of heads were bashed. A lot of people were hurt. But it didn't hurt their true feelings. They all came back for more and more. Nothing. That's when you could tell that nothing could stop us at that time or at any time in the future.
When Stonewall happened, Bruce and I were still in the closet where we had been for nearly 40 years. But we realized that this was a tremendous thing that had happened at Stonewall, and it gave us a feeling that we were not going to be remaining closeted for very much longer. And soon thereafter, we did come out of the closet.
My name is Ginny Apuzzo. In 1969, I was in the convent. And when Stonewall hit the press, it hit me with a bolt of lightning. It was as if I had an incredible release of my own outrage at having to sequester so much of my life. I made my way down. I seem to recall in subsequent nights being down on the, you know, kind of just in the periphery looking, observer, clearly an observer, clearly longing to have that courage to come out. And it was a matter, as I recall, it was only a matter of weeks before I left the convent and started a new life.
I'm Henry Baird. In 1969, I was in the U.S. Army, a Specialist 3 stationed at Long Binh Post near Saigon in Vietnam. I remember I was having lunch in the Army mess, reading the Armed Forces news summary of the day. And there was a short paragraph describing a riot led by homosexuals in Greenwich Village against the police. And my heart was filled with joy. I thought about what I had read frequently, but I had no one to discuss it with. And secretly within myself, I decided that when I came back stateside, if I should survive to come back stateside, I would come out as a gay person. And I did.
For those of us in public morals, after the Stonewall incident, things were completely changed from what they had previously been. They suddenly were not submissive anymore. They now suddenly had gained a new type of courage. And it seemed as if they didn't care anymore about whether their identities were made known. We were now dealing with human beings.
Today I'm a 38-year-old drag queen. I can keep my long hair, I can pluck my eyebrows, and I can work wherever the hell I want.
and I'm not going to change for anybody. If I change, then I feel that I'm losing what 1969 brought into my life. And that was to be totally free.
And that last voice, Sylvia Rivera, in the documentary Remembering Stonewall, produced in 1999 by Dave Isay and Michael Shirker. Today marks the 50th anniversary of the Stonewall Uprising. It began just after midnight tonight, 50 years ago, in Greenwich Village.
This is CKMS.